prayer on my behalf. I always feel obligated to defend my approach here because it seems kind of weird. But, you know, last night where we got to was we were looking at the fallen world in which we live. And I tried to end with a little bit of a preview that says, you know, we can solve some of those issues in our families. And maybe have a better chance in our families than certainly in society at large or the world as a whole, right? Because we have, if we're Christians and we have some respect for God, we kind of know what to do. Some things we talked about is, you know, after the fall, I believe every person now carries around a load of guilt, don't they, in their life. And the more sensitive we are to spiritual things, probably the greater that awareness of our imperfections is. Well, in a godly family, we can somewhat mitigate that by learning to ask for forgiveness and give forgiveness in the family relationship, right? Or I carry around this concern for my own well-being, which is intensified by the fall and the shortages and all of that. But if I'm in a godly family, I learn to be somewhat selfless. I practice that. I work at it. And that can help me overcome the natural self-centeredness and protectiveness and insecurity that comes with living in a world where, you know, things can go really wrong and you might have to do without, that kind of thing. But if I work at it. I almost wish I'd ended last night, but I didn't want to end on a negative note. But I want you to know, I think that's just an inadequate answer. Because on our own, trying to do those kinds of selfless, sacrificial things, I just don't think we're fully equipped to do that in a fallen world by ourselves. And so we're kind of on a journey, and I hope maybe we get there tonight to talk about what enables that very difficult thing of trying to recreate the garden in some way in our own fallen world families. Okay, that whole paragraph there didn't go anywhere except to say we're not there yet. All right, I think there's more to the story than just gritting our teeth and saying, no, we're gonna mitigate the effects of the fall by just doing the right thing in our family. I think that's a great result. We need to aim toward that. But I don't think it's the whole story. And I hope we'll get there tonight with the rest of it. But as men, who's supposed to be leading that effort in our families? And leading in whatever that means, maybe we'll learn more about that today. But I think as dads and fathers and elders in the church and teachers in that role of authority and all of that, especially among Christians, among the redeemed, who is supposed to be in front of the troops, setting the example and leading the way in those efforts to recreate the garden or mitigate the effects of the fall in this life, not only as well as, of course, aiming for the more perfected, the perfect life to come. All right, so that's what we're going to kind of look at this morning. I'm going to back up a little bit and again revisit the effects of the fall, specifically related to men. Well, before I do that, this is my warm-up thought question for this morning. Just in society at large, if I watch TV, watch movies, or whatever, as a guy, okay, who are the heroes generally in the world? I'm not talking about what they ought to be. I'm saying who are the people that, you know, if they say something, they'll be on the news, right? Or that we kind of like to follow them. Or I might even have a T-shirt that has their number on the back or something like that. That's kind of a hint, of course, but you know what I mean. Who are they?
The successful ones.
That's great. I like that answer. But now I'm going to ask you, what do you mean by successful? Great.
They've achieved greatness in whatever field of...
Okay, great. Yeah, so you've abstracted the answer that we're kind of getting to. But Bill, let's back up from his abstract answer, which is whatever they're doing, they're successful at. And who are some of those, and what are they successful at?
Let's athletes.
Athletes. Not just any athlete.
Action heroes.
Right, right. And why all athletes or just some particular athletes?
The good ones.
The really good ones, right, that stand out. They dominate. They turn a team around, you know what I mean. And then you mentioned action figures. Say more about that.
Well, that just, you know, personifies the machismo.
Great. So they may not even be real. Mm-hmm. Like, are those, like Superman, are they real or not? I mean, I've seen pictures of them. They look good. Y'all see what, but his point is, why do I admire that? Why do I enjoy watching that? And the answer is because generally, although it seemed like more lately decades, there's been a darker side of all of them presented, but mostly they kind of smash the bad guy in the end. I mean, that's kind of the whole deal. In fact, the movie kind of is built up to make the bad guy as bad as possible and the good guy, you know, struggling, but you're really happy when that guy's just, you know, bloodied and beaten. And there's always a man-on-man contest near the end of them, which is odd after they've been using laser beams and all that through the whole movie. They got to have hand-to-hand combat at the end. Or maybe it's with, you know, lightsabers, but still, it's kind of, you wonder, why don't they just pull out the ray gun? I remember that, Raiders of the Lost Ark, probably the last movie I've ever seen. It had, what was the guy's name? It was also in Star Wars, Harrison Ford, yeah. The guy comes out, you know, in the marketplace, the Arab guy, and he's got this big old sword, and he's doing all, he's flipping all around, and he just kind of stares at him for a minute. That was the end of that. That was a hilarious scene. I thought that was well done. But it was kind of a comment, really, on the whole idea that you got to have a man-to-man combat near the end. But they dominate, right? They can dominate in strategy, MacGyver kind of guy. They can dominate in physical strength, you know, or superpowers or whatever it is. But that's who we like. And given that, and what about in politics and military and things like that? Same kind of a picture. How about business? Are there heroes in business? Bill Gates, I'm old enough to remember Jack Welch. Y'all know Jack Welch?
Yeah,
GE. And he was famous for saying, you know what? You're going to be number one or number two in your industry, or what? You're gone. That was his strategy. And, you know, he wasn't shy about it. Gone, you know, both at the individual and the corporate level. And so we kind of admire that. As men, I think, more than women. And by the way, I'm going to talk about the women. That's why they're not invited this morning. It might be somewhat offensive to them, but I want to be frank about it. And I think especially in our society that has tried so hard to ignore the obvious differences between men and women. And I think it has leaked in sometimes to our thinking, and we're just concerned about making somebody nervous or generalizing in some sense it's offensive to them. Listen, as Christians, I value the differences God has built within us. And I want to study the Scripture and understand it more deeply. And I will resist, although I find it hard, you know, the pressures of the world to ignore those differences. I'm sorry, but that's what... So, at least we've eliminated that a little bit of stress this morning. I don't have to keep saying, now all women are not like this, or, you know, all those apology things, but let's just talk more frankly about it. We ended with a kind of a sad picture of the world, which is from one generation to the next, we end up having this decline. It's interesting in the descendants of Cain, what kind of people, men or women, who, you know, seem to be setting the example of two wives and pride building the Tower of Babel. It seems to be the men. And I would just say that we're in a somewhat strange culture. I think the evolutionists among us, probably aren't any here, but they would think that we're on a, you know, steady rise. We don't go down, we go up. Everything's better than it used to be. And somehow or another, by our system of laws and all of that, we have made it so that women are, they have equal footing and they can succeed and act just like men and curse and you know, be sexually immoral just like men. You know, in other words, we really want them to look the same, even though they really aren't. But is that the way history has always been, or is that a kind of an exception with regard to women and their ability to compete and their vulnerability and that kind of thing? Where are we? Are we in a kind of a strange period? I see some yeses, and I see most of everybody's going, what is he asking? I don't get that. What I'm trying to say is I think we have created a world in which women are somewhat protected by the laws of our country and other things, some rights that we can protect. And maybe at some point, some political, consensus or something. But listen, all of time, women are vulnerable more than men. You look at any society where the rule of law begins to collapse, who are some of the worst victims? First victims and worst victims. It's women and children, the weaker, right? And in a fallen world, that's a danger. And I think that in that curse that we saw, in fact, I have this one, you remember this little picture here. I think the worst part of man's fallen nature gets expressed toward the weakest people. Maybe weaker men, but also definitely women. I mean, And in general, throughout all of history, women needed the protection of men. I mean, think about it in medical terms. Once a month, there's a kind of a little bit disability that they have to deal with, for example. And there's a weakness, and there's the potential, poaching of other men that women would have to endure. And you don't have to go very far in the world right now to see that where that's happening. And as a more of a natural, and I mean natural in the sense of fallen world natural. Yes, thank you.
Like in Ukraine right now, essentially if you're a man over the age of 18, you are being,
you don't have a choice.
Yeah, you cannot leave the country.
That's right.
So whereas they are deliberately, evacuating their women and children.
Isn't that an odd thing? I can go off on a little tangent here. And I know that the women are just demanding that they get the chance to be Army Rangers and, Navy SEALs and all that. And given that one out of some 100,000 can actually pass the physical test to get in that, somehow our society is just lost. We're just lost. We think they need to have some of those women, but the reason is, do you think those women want to be, Marines and foot soldiers, we'd say in our current army? Because they want to protect the men, is that what their motive is? They need to get out there because those men, man, they'll get hurt if I'm not there to help them. What is the point of, I don't know if you follow this at all, but why is it that you kind of need to be a fighter pilot in the Air Force? You need to have been, through Army Ranger School, Army. Why do you have to do that in the Army? Everybody loves Army Rangers, right? But right.
It's career advancement.
There you go. That's right. If you don't have that on your resume, you'll never be probably wouldn't make colonel, but never going to be a general officer. I'm glad you're nodding. But this is my impression, is that the whole idea of getting into those foundational things is not so you can fight and protect men or other people. It's so you can, that's a career thing. So it's kind of enabling, women to make it to the top ranks. Sorry, that's a tangent. Bring that back to where we're trying to go this morning. But here you see the man, and you see that in this diagram, the way I've drawn it, man is kind of outwardly focused toward accomplishment, where I think women have a more people-oriented task or role in the world. And that's kind of even true after the fall, even though there's these dangers that the man wants to dominate and rule the women, because guess what? He's supposed to dominate and rule in the natural world. So that's kind of his nature has been to do that. Was it supposed to be directed this way? I don't think so. But now after the fall, that's part of it. And to make it worse, there's this dependency, this longing, this sense of, insecurity that the woman who needs the protection of the man has been now placed on the woman after the fall. Okay? Y'all remember that from last night. So that's where we are. I don't have the blanking thing, but I can do this. Do y'all notice any differences between men and women? What's that?
I said I have.
A few, yeah, right. Are their bodies shaped differently? Are they somewhat smaller or larger? Generally smaller, see? There's no women here, so I'm going to say, now, some women are really way bigger than their husbands. I'm saying this is a general rule. I mean, you can nod your head fully. Yeah, that's just the way it is. And I believe God made us that way. Do they have different organs inside their body? Right. We don't want to go into that. I'm glad they do, but different things. And do some of those organs produce different chemicals that kind of run around in their body at different amounts in different times for various reasons?
Yes.
Good reasons. I mean, that's just the way. But I don't have those chemicals, right? I have different chemicals, in fact. Some that women don't have at a chemical level. Are they different actually at a molecular level?
100%.
That's a yes? Do they actually have differences like right at the chromosome level? Yeah, I mean, brain size. We'll go into which is larger, but I'm not sure size correlates to them. It's just built differently. And we will notice and talk about some differences in their personality. Some of that's speculation, but I'll just say we know that. We just know that. And another side branch here. There's some sense that you can, by means of surgical, I'll call it mutilation, change sexes. That's the dumbest thing I've ever heard. You realize that women have... y'all help me with this, that know more about this, but, you know, they have different shapes in their hips because I guess babies have to come out, right? And, there, you know, what happens then is that would get in the way of your arms, so their arms are actually pointed differently. Are you going to get all that fixed by surgery? I mean, change your hip bone shape and then, like, fix your arms so they go out in a different way? You know what I'm saying there? No. Are you going to fix the chromosomes in your body? You're going to... Okay, so pull that back. I don't mean to get into that, but that's just, I don't know where we are in this world, but that's kind of what the thought is. You can somehow, because somewhere in your brains, you know, something flipped and you think you're a woman, then somehow you can make yourself into one. And the government even should pay for that. Sorry, I'm way on that. So. We're back here.
Marty, unless you're a biologist, I'm not sure you're qualified to talk about it.
Well, okay. Sorry. Thanks for... So really, if we, I know, that's what I was going to say. I was going to say, I think we're all qualified because we live in this world. And a lot of us live with women or have lived with women for a long time. So let's keep going, given there are no women here to kind of punch us in the side or, you know, do any of that. But, okay. This is an interesting... I'm just looking at the Bible text. Paul mentions in the first letter to the Thessalonians how much he cared for those Christians. You may know the whole story about it. He wasn't there very long, and he did have a good reception there until he's run out of town by those from, I don't know, can't remember why he left. I guess, it was opposition in the city, maybe 3 weeks or not much more. But let's look at what he says. We were gentle among you as a nursing mother cherishes her own children. And notice down here he says, and charged every one of you as a father does his own children. You see that? He mentions that I'm both a mother and a father to you. But he describes what a mother does and a father does in very different terms. You see that? Let's see if I can underline. What does a mother do? Affectionate longing. And I don't know what makes it mothers do that, but they'll kill themselves to take care of a baby. Right? I don't quite have that deep emotional, almost irrational protective urge that way. Paul said he wanted to impart not our own lives also, because you had become dear to us. See, I'm using pink, by the way. Did you notice that? I thought that was clever for that. And you, our labor and toil, laboring night and day. Is that a mom? Especially a newborn, just you're not going to sleep. And somehow or another, they just find a way to do it. Laboring night and day, but and they're not they don't want to burden you at all. They're always trying to find some sacrificial way to take care of the needs, and often even to a fault. When a child grows up and maybe doesn't need that kind of enabling, but the mom is usually the one who's going to kind of be there, slip them some money on the side, you know, things that might not be the very best for their soul, but still, boy, that her heart is just broken for this. Y'all have seen this. You know what I'm talking about. But what does a father do? Devoutly and justly and blamelessly we behaved ourselves toward you as we exhorted and encouraged and charged every one of you to walk worthy. Does that sound like more like a male thing? You can do better than that. Come on. You know, or that was dumb. You shouldn't have done it. You know, or something. This is more the male thing, right? Because we've got to, this is the goal line. We're trying to get to that. We have to try to accomplish something. So even in Paul's example that he uses, you can kind of see already there's, yeah, men and women are somewhat different, even in the verbs that he uses there. And you see in throughout the Bible text that husband, oh, you know what, I'm going to go back to the chart a while ago that I skipped over and just talk about our own observations. Notice, the wife is described as the weaker vessel. We can go in a lot of details about that. It just says there's a difference to start with. And if she's weaker, what's the man in whatever dimension? Stronger. The stronger. So, and there's a responsibility that comes from that. Right. I like the passage in Ruth. Ruth, who needed desperately the financial and societal approval, being a Moabitess, I guess, especially, of a man, of a family, of an inheritance. And so she says, I believe the spread your garment over me is not a, like, I'm cold, you know, here on the threshing floor. Let me share your blanket. I think she's saying, put your protective wing, because that's the way that phrases used in other places. She's saying, I need a protector. Spread the wing of your protection and guardianship over me. That's what Ruth was asking for from Boaz. And then husbands, love your wives and gave himself and love the wives as their own bodies is really suggesting a sacrificial care. Now let's go back, because I did want to spend a little time on this. You don't have to actually go to the scriptures. You can look in the world and just see things that reflect the difference between men and women. I'll go these quickly. I found this interesting, and I didn't do serious, exhaustive research. Started popping up men and women in fantasy football. This will be a shocker to you. Did you know that 81% of the 33 million fantasy football players, and I don't know much about it, by the way. I'm not one. I hope that's not effeminate that I'm not doing fantasy football. I don't think that's the point of this statistic. But anyway, there's some empirical evidence that men tend to focus more on achievement in these video games, right? Leveling up rapidly. Y'all know what leveling up means? That means it means something is competitive, I guess, right? Is that the idea?
Like training, practicing.
Okay, but it helps you get better scores and, okay, good. Gaining in-game status and competing against others. While women, big shocker, are drawn to social interactions, whether it's helping other players, what? Or forming long-term relationships. Last time I was up in Elmira, I was playing this little Uno, like it wasn't Uno, but it's like that, where you know you try to get rid of all your cards and you can reverse the flow, and that was kind of the thing. But you can see everybody's cards that are out there, and you draw one and decide what to do. And I was helping Leanne. She's 4. And Mary was there. She's 6. And then Beth works. And then her mom was there. We're playing. And so Beth is down to 1 card, you know. And so, you know, Leanne had a couple of cards she could play. But one, obviously, her mom would win. She'd go out. If we put that card down, she was next. Boom, game's over, you know. So Leanne picks up that card. And I said, wait, Leanne, I'm helping her, you know. I said, don't play that. Your mom will win. She said, I know. That'd be good. And it dawned on me, I'm sitting there playing with women. You know what I mean? They forget what the game is for. But I'm exaggerating some of you, but that's kind of more the natural state of things. And you can see that in these competitive things. And what about courage challenges? Base jumping, wing suiting. You know what the little squirrel suit things that jump off mountains? And you know, you've seen that, videos of that. Skydiving, rock climbing, bull riding, dare challenges of various kinds, graffiti. Who are the primary players in those activities? And really, if you Google women in and then rock climbing or whatever, you will find an article. But you know what the whole point of the article is?
There aren't many women who do
that. That's exactly right. Again, you probably think this is a male sport, but so-and-so, then from there it's a human interest story. Y'all know what I'm talking about. It's almost like proving the rule by the exception, by saying, yeah, this is a really rare thing. And this woman who's, by the way, not better than all the men by a long shot, but kind of a weird thing. I mean, worth writing an article about. And that's kind of the way they read. But you know that. And in terms of tinkering, building, craftsmanship, I mean, you all know the attraction of those things, right? Fix up an old car. You know, how many girls do that, really? Is it because we don't let them? That's what the world would have you believe, is somehow we program them by duct taping Barbie dolls to their hands when they're in the crib, you know, so they can't do anything else. But that's not it. And then here's a graph of the SAT scores over the period 67, and feminism, you know, version 1.0 was kind of in this period. And you can see the test as a whole got easier, or no, harder, sorry, harder. And and then, of course, I graduated right in here, and so then they made it easier. But do you see what happened? These are the math scores with the men and the women. And no matter how hard or easy the test was, there was always this gap in the math scores. Is that because girls are excluded from math classes? It turns out that actually girls tend to make better grades, even in math, in school. I'm not encouraging that it's masculine to make bad grades, okay? That's the opposite of what I want to say. But still, it is the case that generally girls make better grades. I mean, I could explain that various ways. One is, I think they want to please their teachers. And maybe the guys in an early age, because they mature later, struggle with school, and they may begin to see school as a kind of a girl thing. And so failing at school may be kind of one of their expressions of kind of mistaken masculinity. No, I'm interested in the playground, in the football game, in Little League after school. Girls' stuff is like school and studying and making grades and things like that. And yet, the aptitude tests show men do better. Now, we talked about war heroism. Great example. I've thought about that every time they mention that. And it expresses, too, not just the fact that men have that responsibility of defense, and they're able, I mean, more able than the women, but it's just their nature. I mean, you talk to them, and even the women will have some measure of patriotism, but they want to collect food and send it. You know, they want to do those kinds of things, whereas the men are ready to die for that. And so that's something respected. And I believe it also begins to let us see what the world would look like if we didn't have kind of some civil society around us. And that is, the women would be the victims and it would be difficult. Now, this will not surprise you. Did you know that 89% of the homicides are committed by men? Is that because women can't fire a pistol and shoot somebody, which is the way most of the homicides occur? It's not, I don't think. It doesn't explain the 90%. 88% of robberies, 85% of burglaries, 83% of arsons, 82% of vandalism, 82% of motor vehicle theft, 78% of aggravated assault, which, by the way, that number is kind of going down. I think as women have more and more occasion to worry about defending themselves, and 80% of offenses against family and children. How do you explain that? This is the darker side, you see. Whatever it is that, you know, pushes men into, you know, skydiving or something like that, when things are tough, it pushes them into this kind of behavior, I think. Now, I'm making some of that up, but I'm saying. And sexual aggression. And I think the Me Too movement, if it did anything, it should have convinced the world that men and women are different. How many men came forward and said, yes, I've had sexual harassment in the workplace? And how many men came forward and said, I didn't think it was sexual harassment, you know? And the women are saying, you don't understand how it feels, you know, that kind of thing. That should have shouted to people, you know, men and women are different in the way they perceive things and the things they're tempted to do to other people and so on. But it highlighted the what's become known as the, what's it called, a toxic masculinity. That's the phrase. You know what I'm talking about. And that's the, I think, a more feminine view of what men can become because of the inclinations in a fallen world, right? But anyway, so I'm just telling you, you have to work really hard to ignore the differences between men and women. And yet, when we looked at the roles, or we looked at the garden, before the fall, even before the fall, were there some tough things that men had to do? We talked about that.
Tending the garden,
yeah. And actually they had dominion over the, not just like cows and sheep, but over like sea creatures and things. I don't have any idea how that would be done. But I'm pretty sure it would take some degree of courage, physical strength, planning, risk-taking, failure and try again. You know, what's the word for that? You know, trial and error, I should say. Yeah. Now, the world is not that way anymore. I'm not saying, but before the fall, I think men had their certain degree of courage and other things that they would have. And God put it in them, and he gave them something to do with it, right? But in a fallen world, you see how those characteristics can be misdirected toward women, toward weaker people, right? Toward some kind of course, we're now all taught that the survival of the fittest is the law of nature, right? So free enterprise, if you can, you know, undercut your competitor down the street, even if it's a brother in Christ, but I can beat him, you know, in business, that's fair game. That's a different part of my life, of course. You know, but I can... that's what I'm supposed to do. That's free enterprise at work. What better system in the world is there than free enterprise, where the stronger beats the weaker? Isn't that the idea? I mean, Darwin proved that's the way the whole world operates, didn't he? Y'all know the difference when I'm being facetious and I'm not. Okay, but you see what I'm saying? That's the male character, I think, being pushed into various other aspects of our life in a fallen world. Sorry, you don't. You're tired of seeing all these. So let's talk about that. Tell me some differences between men and women and the way they think, and the way they talk, the way they interact with others. Just some of the ideas you've observed. Besides the fact that they generally don't go base jumping or whatever that sport is.
Sometimes women are more detail-oriented.
Okay. More attention to detail. And so often in the old days, you could count on them to know how to sew and stitch and cook complicated things and, you know, all of those things which require attention to detail. Okay?
Just the way we think.
Talk some more about that.
For me, it's
there's no women here. That's by design. So they're just stupid, and they're stupid, and men are smart. Okay, next thing.
We have a topic, and I want to talk about that topic until it's exhausted. Mm-hmm.
And finish, and stop talking about it.
Yes, finish it so we can move on to something else.
Exactly.
Sometimes it seems like you're talking about what children are going to do after school, and then somehow we're talking about orange shoes. In, you know, 30 seconds flat. And I'm like, how did we get here and why are we talking about mm-hmm. this? Has nothing to do with what the original topic was. It's not linear, it's
abstract.
It's abstract. It jumps, though, just the yeah. thought process.
I'm glad I'd never go on tangents. That would be effeminate, too. But no, exactly. And you might come back to what the children are going to do after school again.
Yes.
After a while.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There was a Facebook meme one time or so, the way men and women think.
Yeah.
One man, railroad tracks going one way.
Yeah.
And the other one was a train yard with all these trucks.
Yeah, going out there. And so I'm looping around, you know. I mean.
Better yeah. waffles, women or spaghetti.
Yeah. Interesting. Yeah. And I'll say this, even though there aren't women here, I am not talking about good and bad. But since it kind of matches our temperament, our disposition, we tend to think, well, that's the way you ought to think. You ought to not keep talking about different stuff or revisiting a topic without solving it or, you know what I mean, or solving it four or five times again, you know, or whatever. Yeah.
I'm talking to you to solve it. I just want you to listen.
That is key. In fact, in the end, the talking about it is the thing, not the conclusion you come to. And I think men finally figure out, usually after 10 years or more, because we're so slow at things like that, that when women have a problem, they want to talk about the problem. They don't want you to solve it. And in our mind, the quicker we solve it, the better. But you see, if you value the conversation, that's like the worst thing you can do. Well, the easy answer is don't ever talk to that person again. Okay, now, look what we talk about next. That was easy enough. You know what I'm talking about there. You ever go to, I'm sure you have potlucks, all the churches together. Maybe you have other events like that. Do the men tend to collect together and talk about stuff? Yeah, I mean, you observed that, right? No matter, and the women are in sometimes the other room, but Jeremy, and even not, they sometimes will say men in here, women in there, because they kind of know, well, it's going to happen anyway, I guess. And to make sure the men get the better chairs or whatever, but what do they talk about? You ever listen in on the
anything and everything?
In what juicy how?
I'm talking about people.
Oh. Right, relationships and kids here and that.
How we feel about it.
And how we, yeah. And what are the men talking about? Slip in there in the men's conversation.
Sports.
Stuff, you know, facts, events, media, stories. That, you know what I mean. It's all about that. Less about relationships and you know, personal interactions and that kind of thing. You give that a try, and I think you'll find that's the case. All right, I have a few. One again, I'm sorry that we did this read Marty's mind thing, but I'll just put some up here, most of which we've kind of briefly discussed. I think in general, women, and we saw this in the, I think I see it in the curses, they're generally in a relationship seeking security and affection, right? Whereas men, I think, more motivating to us is we want to be successful. We want to be approved of, perceived as successful, not just successful. We want to be respected. And that's an important thing. There's some sense of marriage counseling in what these charts are about, but that's not where I'm going. But if you're a husband and struggling, I think you ought to maybe try thinking in these terms and say what she's really after is really some affirmation that she is valued, she's the only woman, she's the most beautiful woman, all the things we talked about. That's way more important. For us, however, we want her to tell us we're the strongest guy, the best guy, the most successful guy, because that's kind of what drives us. That's counseling, but anyway. Women value the experience. Men say, well, let's get to the goal. Let's finish. Let's win, right? Let's solve this and get it, fix it, whatever it is. Women want stable relationships, and in general, men tend to want to kind of be in control. And when we get out of control, we start to get somewhat impatient and sometimes respond in a very wrong way. For a woman, so I mentioned this, feelings are way more significant. And what's difficult is, as a man, it's hard for me to hear the expressions of that and for those words to make any sense to me, because that's not the way I think about it. I don't start with how I feel about something. Whereas men, I prefer logic, black and white. Often women will take, as Gary calls it, the spaghetti approach, a spiral approach. Let's revisit, let's talk about it again. In fact, here's a more discussion of feelings about that event, which really are not, you know, linearly moving us toward an answer. Whereas the man wants to be linear, reason to an end point. Women focus on feelings, as I mentioned before, whereas a man would focus on the external events and facts. And of course, for women, emotion, more volatile, meaning, you know, crying about things is more acceptable. And men, we admire emotional control, which I'm learning as I get older, and I guess I mentioned somebody, my testosterone's getting lower or something, I don't know. But I don't know if you older guys, I find myself, you know, getting tearful more than I'm used to. You know, it's definitely increasing with time. Anyway, and then for a woman, how it's said is paramount, and for a man, it's what it said. And this happened a lot with Mary and myself. She would say, I mean, we have something, and you know, or something come up. She said, well, I thought you said you didn't like that. And of course, I remember what I said. I did not say I didn't like that. You know what I'm getting at here. But whatever I said, you know, and I remember the exact words. That's what I remember, the words, right? And I get it right. Whatever I said, the way she heard it, because of the way I said it was, I didn't like it. And which is probably more true, what I actually said or what she perceived? What she perceived. Y'all probably had this experience. And so really the way you say things, and men love to hide behind the literal words that I actually said, right? That's stupid. That is not the way women hear. They hear what you feel, which is often closer to the truth than what the literal words were. So I'm telling you, again, the intent is not counseling, but if you're in a relationship that's close enough that you have discussions of that, think about how you're saying it, even maybe more so. And the words of relationship and affirmation that surround what you're saying, and right? And the events that led up to that, because it's not just that isolated syllables that you said, it's all the things that surrounded that. That's what women will see. And again, I'm not saying good or bad, but I'm saying you need to be aware of that difference and accommodate it and learn about how to do it. So what it said, so those are differences. So these are the things that we said kind of typify men. But here's a point I want to make. I'm going to move those over to the left. And I'd like to think about the fact that, yes, these are not good or bad, but is it possible that these create some kind of extra temptation for men? That maybe women don't have. They have their own sets of temptation, where their need for security might lead them to have an affair with somebody who makes them feel warm, and they would start with this relationship. That's the temptation to them, is that they have a soulmate. Is that the temptation for men to be unfaithful generally? Is they find a soulmate and after a while? It's the other way around. What are men tempted by? Sight, right? Lust, right. And so, but and I could kind of go down that path a little bit further, again, another tangent, but the thing that hurts a woman the most about a man who's been unfaithful is she sometimes most often will perceive what he has done in light of what would happen if she had done it. And so what she sees is not that he's had an affair, but that he has formed a new soulmate and displaced her in that close relationship, because that's the way she thinks it happened, because that's the way it would work with her. Now, it's true some women will build the ego of a man up when they're like the Proverbs 7 woman, you know, that's part of their, but they know what gets to a man. But in general, he's kind of just tempted in a carnal way, as you say. And the last thing he probably wants is to form a holistic relationship with this strange woman. But for a woman, that would be more of the temptation, I think. I'm sorry, that was a tangent, but in counseling sometimes when there's been unfaithfulness, you have to understand, kind of help the woman see what the temptation was and what it wasn't. That's important. Anyway, what's the danger if you seek approval and respect as the primary thing in your life? Is that you might actually be demanding of that respect, and proud and arrogant of what you've done and maybe bragging about that. We saw that in the person of Lamech. You remember that? If I'm goal-oriented and I'm focused on accomplishment, might I be tempted to think that winning is everything and a loser is a loser? And that's the way I view the world. Those who succeed and don't succeed in some carnal way. Maybe it's business, right? Maybe it's personal domination in the workplace. Maybe it's political power. Maybe I'm looking at my bank account and other things as a measure of my success. And the other things are subordinate to that because winning is paramount. And I disrespect those who have not succeeded in, of course, in the ways that I've succeeded, even though they may have succeeded in other ways. I want to control. I don't want to be controlled. And so is there danger that you would want to dominate and you would always want to seek your own way? Because after all, in a fallen world, if you don't strike first, you may be the victim of not doing that. I prefer logic. Well, maybe I always want to be right. So when I get into discussion, that discussion always is kind of being manipulated. So in the end, I can prove that what I said at the beginning was right. Right? Even if I have to redefine every word in that statement. But somehow or another, I was right, you know. Right? I don't make mistakes. But, and, whoops, let me, I'm going to reason to an end point. So I'm impatient, and I'm not tolerant of people who are indecisive or who maybe have some hesitation or some concerns or who are thinking about it from a different point of view. Let's move out. Let's get this done. And I admire emotional stability as a result of that. I suppress my sympathies, which we're told to have bowels of compassion in the old King James language. Something inside my body needs to move. And by the way, that's a command to develop that capability. And I think for men, it's difficult. Can I really be sympathetic? When I hear somebody suffering and I see their anxiety, whatever it is there a resonance? I'm on that frequency inside my own bowels. And I begin to feel that same pain, anxiety, and I'm sympathetic for that reason. Not only that, but I might see emotional instability as a weakness. That sympathy that you have for others, I might say, boy, I'm glad I'm not that, you know, weepy about everything, you know, because I think as men, we're not weepy, you know, that's important. And then, of course, what is said is matters most, which means I just tell you what I'm thinking, right? I just tell it the way it is. I don't beat around the bush and all those kind of things, which are sound like virtues in some way. But remember that how it's said is part of the whole picture of communication, especially with women. Are these temptations that we sometimes face? And they're the result of, I think, some of the good things God put in man to conquer the world, to have dominion, but also exaggerated by the fall. You see how that works probably in a bad way together, but that's where we are. And I want you to think about some opposite words, proud and demanding, and I'm thinking of the phrase, lest he be puffed up, not self-willed, not quarrelsome, not quick-tempered. Are you recognizing these phrases? Hospitable, gentle, good behavior, not violent. What are those? They're qualifications of elders. Isn't that interesting? And, you know, one thing to think about is about these qualifications is how boring they are. You know, I think we were here before. We said we ain't talking about the qualification. Sort that out yourself. We talked about the work. But think about them for a minute. How many of them are like, start with, they're not this? I think 6 or 7 of them, which is kind of a negative statement. Whatever they are, they're not this, right? They're not quick-tempered. They're not a novice. They're not given to much wine. They're not... what is the filthy lucre in the old, you know what I mean? That's just not, they're not that. Well, okay, what are they? That's one thing. And the other thing is, if you look at that list, does it say they are clever, aggressive, charismatic, creative, they're closure-oriented, right? They're driven. You hear those words? Is that in the list of qualifications? It's not. It's not on the... And yet, as men, what do we want in our leaders? Decisive, quality conscious, customer oriented, right? Goal focused, you know, and charismatic, of course. I'm telling you, that's not in there as qualifications of elders. It's interesting, isn't it? Now, some of those, if you're well organized, which is also not in the list, thankfully, but it isn't. But if I am well organized, might that be a help? I'm not saying they're wrong to have, but it doesn't show up as the primary list of qualifications. You know, and despite, so I can talk about this. The worldly male character, I think, is giving in to the natural man, and who does not receive the things of the Spirit. And yet, sometimes, if you don't believe in a fallen world, you say, well, that's just the way I am. And isn't that a kind of way of saying, well, yeah, of course it is. We're in a fallen world, so you've got to fix that. We're in trouble. But if you don't believe in a fallen world, you say, well, that's natural, right? Just like a cow is a cow, and a cow does what a cow does, and it's not wrong or right, and you know what I mean? They just... Do you see how you kind of have this sense of conflict that if we're not conscious of that... and so you have, we follow our natural inclinations, and there's no higher authority. We survive in an evolutionary model where the stronger live longer. We live for ourselves because this is all there is, survival, benefit, and fulfilled desires and ambition. That's the natural man. And you can see that described in several passages. The wisdom that's not from above in James, for example, has almost all these characteristics we've described down the danger side on the right-hand side. So those are some of them. And it's propagated by our rights-oriented culture, make sure I get what's mine. Is that biblical? It's like the rights for life, liberty, and the pursuit of... Is that the Bible goal for life? But wait, it's in America. It has to be Christian.
You're saying the concept of rights as those things which are expressed in the Scriptures?
No. I'm saying the fact that they are kind of the foundation of our thinking about our country and our citizenship, right to vote, all those things, they're not in the Scriptures.
Oh, right. I'm not talking about the right to vote.
Well, I'm talking about the right to pursue happiness. And I know this is radical, and I'm not trying to be anti-patriotic here, but is that the basis of a Christian's worldview? Is I need to have the right to pursue happiness as a foundational thing. My
very
right.
Self-focused.
It is, isn't it? That's an interesting thing. In fact, look up the word rights, even in the New Testament, the writing of Paul, rights generally. Does there, Paul ever talk about, I have a right to this or that? Can you think of a place? Isn't that an interesting thing? When he brings it up in more than one place, he said, but I didn't do it. Why? Back to your answer. Because it wouldn't have been best for that Corinthian church for him to take money from them for the work he was trying to do there. And he has a right to lead about a wife. Why didn't he do that? He had the right. Is there something bigger than rights, I guess, is maybe a better way to ask the question. Yeah, there is. In Christ there is. Because this world is not all there is, see. I mean, if you don't believe that, then what I'm saying doesn't make any sense. Y'all, thanks for taking your breaks as we go, right? So you get to sit there through the break when we actually take it, okay? I'm just kidding. There is one right in the Scripture. And John mentions it in the first chapter. We have one right that God encourages us to exercise. Which is what?
To become the children.
Thank you. Exactly right. And is that huge? To become a son of God? What a privilege. I mean, how could we ever achieve that? And there's a requirement for that that's given. But it's interesting, the discussion of rights. I'm on a tangent, but we can talk some more about that. Yes, behind the post.
I'm not sure if you'll do this at some point, but could we talk a little bit, a lot of the characteristics are these male characteristics, the father, the man.
Yeah, yeah.
But we have a lot of young men here.
Yes.
Who still need to submit and obey to their mothers.
Sure.
And these can be conflicts as mm-hmm. men mature and grow to want to be, you know, the keeper, to want to lead.
Yeah.
How do we balance that?
Thank you.
Fathers and
right. So I hope what I'm getting to, especially in the next session, addresses some of that. I'm just trying to paint a picture that God has given men a certain nature. And it's a dangerous thing. It's a powerful thing, but it often is in our fallen world, directed in the wrong way. And as Christian men, that kind of begs a question. So why did God give me all these temptations? Right, all these kind of problems that I have to wrestle with. I wonder what that is. I'm pretty sure, as we saw in the other chart, it's not to dominate the wife or the Christians if I'm an elder in the church or something like that. There must be something else going on because some of that was there before the fall. It's not evil. right? And some of it is made worse, but I think like Satan does with everything else, what can he use to tempt us with? Only what God's made, right? He can only use the tree that God put in the garden, you know, as a way to tempt Eve. Same thing with all our natural desires. He can, but anyway, I'm trying to get there, but thank you. And if I'm not making point, or help me make that point. But I would say to the younger guys, you will begin to feel within yourself, especially as those hormones start working in your body. They haven't yet. Enjoy it while you can. But you will start to feel these feelings, like, am I a failure because I'm not good in sports, that's like the upside down, but the same thing. Or am I better than everybody else because I am good at sports, right? Or I've got to work hard to beat these other people. That's really the measure of my success. I got to have the best batting average, or get the best job, or go to the best university, or make the most money, or something. Have the biggest house. You know what I mean? Is that our measure? But you'll begin to feel that competitiveness. And I want you to look for that and think about how maybe God intends us to use that. That's where I'm trying to go with this. Does that help a little bit? Okay, I'm going to skip over this. The worldly view, of course, our role models. You guys told me some of those sports heroes, because they're winners. They're big guys. They could beat you up if you threaten them. And by the way, and how much do we look into their moral character as we lift them up as our examples? You know, how many times have they been married? It was interesting to me that, you know, before Trump, I think maybe only one other president, you know, had been to, you know, I would say betrayed his wife and married another woman. Do y'all know who that was? Reagan. And then Trump comes in and he's like on his third or something. And nobody bring that up as a question of moral character. But he was trying to be an elder in the church. Would he even, husband of one wife? I mean, nope, check him off. I mean, among other things. So, yeah, and yet it's admired and so on. So can you think of some macho men in the Bible who followed that model?
Samson.
Yeah, Samson always kind of mentioned first. Yeah, right. And who? Others, just others.
Saul.
Yeah, Saul, not the apostle that became Paul, but the king, yeah. Right, exactly. So we started with Lamech. Esau was the outdoorsman, huntsman, you know, he was the guy that, of course, all that kind of came back on him. He was such an impulsive fellow, figured he'd starve. He sold his birthright, you know, kind of a silly thing to do. Simeon and Levi, remember them, sons of Jacob, who they got revenge on that guy, Shechem, I think his name was, in the city. But were they winners? Because they responded in kind, in fact, stronger, and they showed, no, Jacob said, you don't know what kind of harm you've done here. Yep.
What did Jacob do to address what had happened to Dana?
I don't know. Well, in the end, he didn't do anything. I'm not sure what he should have done, but I was starting to answer the question, what did he do to these two? And he did do something to them. It seemed like that part of the prophecy there was that they would not have the inheritance or something like that. Yeah, good point. I mean, what should he have done? I don't know the answer to that.
Yeah, I think we often, because, you know, if Job is contemporary or
something, somewhere around. Yep, thank you.
You know, Job 28 talks about how he avenged the widow and he was bathed in justice.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
He crushed the oppressed.
Yeah, yeah.
Or crushed the wicked, I'm sorry. And so, like, there are things that are left, I don't want to say left out, but
yeah.
I don't know what the outcome of it is because it's not said.
Yeah.
But we often go to this and disparage these brothers, mm-hmm. And then don't talk about the other side.
What should they have done, or what should have been done?
Justice meted out in those
yeah.
Days.
Again, my male character is coming out here to want to be right on this discussion. I'm not so sure that was it Shechem, right? That was the guy's name?
Yeah.
Did he actually rape the girl, or did he kind of just seduce her and then wanted to marry her?
Well,
I'm looking to Gary. I'm sure you know the answer to that.
He still loved her after it happened.
Isn't that interesting?
Which is unusual from how we see another.
However it happened, yes.
But she told him not to do it, and he did it anyway.
Is that true in that story, or is that Amnon and Tamar? See, we're having a nice male discussion about who's right here. Anyway, I guess I'm going to say that whether Jacob did the right thing or not, Simeon and Levi, I believe, did not. I think they went beyond, and Jacob condemns them for their over-revenge. Maybe that boy should have been punished or something should have been worked out. But yeah, I don't know.
Jacob was more concerned about how the other nations would
see him. Yeah, the family reputation. Thank you. That's all good, too. All right. I don't want to take more time because I think I'm losing the argument, so let's move on here. Anyway, y'all look that up and we can talk about it. This is what Jacob said about them. Instruments of cruelty are in their dwelling place. For in their anger they slew a man. Their self-will they hamstrung an ox. The cursed be their anger, it's fierce, and their wrath for it's cruel. That sounds like the macho man at work, whether they were doing the right thing or not. But Samson, you've already mentioned. Saul, you mentioned. Nabal, you remember his reaction to David. And David said, look, I've kind of been protecting your property here. Can you just give us some food for my men? And Nabal said, well, you know, there's a lot of runaway slaves nowadays, and kind of pretty trash-talky kind of a guy. Rehoboam and his advisors, we can mention that. Doesn't this sound like a trash talk? Okay. And yet, and this is the comma but part, who was given the roles of leadership, both in spiritual things and civil matters? Who was given the role of leadership in the Old Testament, despite these male characteristics? You know the answer. I mean, fathers, elders, able judges and rulers, that's where Moses accepts Jethro's advice. You remember that story? Priests, there were leaders, governors, commanders in various enterprises, and of course the soldiers, captains and officers, judges were all men. And I'm not going to quibble about Deborah because I'll talk about that Sunday morning. Kings, teachers, prophets. And in the New Testament, did that continue with regard to men's roles? Yeah, elders, all those things. And the interesting thing, and we've already kind of hinted that in the qualifications of these leaders, what was God looking for in these leaders?
Men after his heart.
Okay, that's interesting that said about David. Was he looking for, let's just look and just see what we can see. Abraham. Why was Abraham chosen, according to this passage there, in Genesis 18, in that encounter before the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah? And God is kind of speaking to himself in a way, saying, you know, I should let him in on what's going to happen because I've chosen him, that he may command his children's household to keep the ways of the Lord. In a way, Abraham was qualified by that existing quality, wasn't he? To be the father of many nations and the father of the faithful forever. And Jethro's advice to Moses, when he says, you're going to kill yourself from morning till evening, taking care of these squabbles between the people, he said, you know what? Choose able men, right, who are skilled lawyers, right, who are excellent negotiators. You know, that's not what he says. He says, who fear God first, and they're men of truth, and they hate covetousness. And you know, if they have that quality, they'll be good judges somehow or another, because that's the basis of the way they think about things. Does those sound familiar? Soldiers. You know, there's one qualification for soldiers. They didn't try out like the Benjamites could, you know, we learned later, could use both hands, right? Benjamites were left-handed predominantly, but they could sling a sling with both hands and not miss. They were warriors. In fact, you can kind of see that at the end of the book of Judges. That little, you know, overmatched set of men in Benjamite, they almost took out the whole nation. They were warriors. But what was the real qualification for soldiers according to the law? There's really one thing. And Gideon ended up using this qualification to, God told him to
fend. Their hearts didn't tremble.
That's exactly right. And that kind of comes from the law. What man is there who is fearful and faint-hearted? Deuteronomy 20. Go to your house, lest the heart of his brethren faint like his. It's interesting. It wasn't a military strength or something. They were sure enough men who had to fight. But what God wanted was men who were confident, not because of themselves, but because of their faith in him. King David, God looks at the heart, Samuel was told. King Solomon, this is what David told him. He said, here's what you need to do. Know the God of your father. Serve him with a loyal heart, a willing hand. Because the Lord searches the hearts and intents of the thoughts, and the Lord has chosen you. In Acts 6, I call them the proto-deacons. I don't know what else to call them, but they're men of what? They're good cooks. They can take care of those widows, right? They're great at logistics. They can arrange the supply chain so that the widows are never without. Is that what he said? It's interesting, the qualifications had very little to do with the actual tasks that they'd be executing, but what was important as those Christians looked out from among themselves? What was it? Good reputation, full of the Holy Spirit and wisdom. That was their qualification. And that reminds me of the elders. The things elders have to do sometimes do require maybe a charismatic thing to convince the group this is a good plan or keep people from being discouraged over some event that's happened. I think that's a useful skill, but that's not in the qualifications. It's just that they have this deep fear for God and humility, and they're not self-willed, and they're interested in others and so on. Elders, there we go, same thing. Prayer leaders, men, everywhere, pray, lifting up what? Holy hands without wrath and disputing. Does that sound familiar? Men who love to be angry, and that's an expression of their maleness, right? And they love to win arguments. That's maybe the idea of disputing here. No, that doesn't characterize us at all. And then teachers are, according to Paul's instructions, they're an example in word, in manner of life, in love, in faith. And they're great speakers, and they do PowerPoint really well. No, it's something else about their life and their disposition. Y'all see what I'm trying to say here? Does this represent a challenge to have this quality in a fallen world as men? But that's what God says leaders need to be. Based on the encouragement from the back row, I'm going to say the young guys again. The qualities you need to develop are not competitiveness and a winning spirit. You kind of have that already in one way or another. What you need to learn is these things that govern it and direct it in the right way. And maybe you learn some of that by playing sports and doing your best at it. But that's not because that's what life is about, is beating other people. It's because that character then, directed by our qualities as Christians, is what God wants us to be. Before I get to this, this session takes a little longer. The next one is much shorter. But in the book, I have this self-assessment score sheet. I like to take about 5 minutes, and you can do this and take a break and come back and we'll finish. But just go down through there, and I have put a score on there from 0 to 3. And I'll just hint to you that 0 is bad and 4 is good. Or 3 is good. And I always have 4 because that way you can't pick a middle one. I'm not either one or the other. You have to be on one side or the other of neutral. But you'll also notice that sometimes the questions are reversed because I can't quite state them in a positive way. So over here, do you keep commitments? Seldom is not good. Always is good. Over here, are you deceptive or conniving to gain advantage, get your way, build your reputation, ensure that you win, and often is bad? Right, and seldom. So I've tried to keep the bad answers on the left and the good answers on the right. So I just want you to do a self-assessment. And the point of this is that we're going to share all the results with everybody else. No, that's not it. The point of it is that you pick 2 or 3 that you know you need to work on and think about it and share maybe with a wife or somebody else who can help you. That's where we're going. No secrets here. So take time, do this. You shouldn't take very long. And just do a self-assessment here on these. And I hope you recognize some of these points as what we've covered.